Turn to the book of Exodus chapter 20, and we're going to start there. We've been in this series on the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words. And really, you can break up the Ten Commandments into two categories. The first three to four commands deal with our relationship with God. So this idea of no other gods, no idols or images of God, taking care with how we speak the name of God. And then this command for the Sabbath, it's kind of a pivot point. The Sabbath, we're told, is a Sabbath to the Lord our God. But we're also told that on the Sabbath, it's not just you who rest. It's your family, it's your animals, it's your slaves, it's the immigrants among you. Everybody gets a divine day off. And so this becomes a pivot point. So the first three to four commands deal with our relationship with God. The last six to seven commands deal with how we interact with one another. And I think if we need to spend time on anything, it's probably how in the world do we interact with one another. I think that if you take the Bible seriously, this guy Paul comes along and says, if you want to sum up everything in the law, then sum it up in these words: love your neighbor as yourself. And it's possible that you could be theologically correct. I think it's impossible, but let's just, for the sake of argument, you could be theologically correct about everything about God. But if you don't love your neighbor well, then you and God aren't on good terms. And it's something about how we treat one another, the image bearers of God in the world. It's the dignity and compassion we extend to one another that somehow grows and deepens our relationship with God. And so we begin this journey today of reflecting on this idea of each other by looking at this command, the fifth word: honor your father and mother, so that your life will be long in the fertile land that the Lord your God has given you. Honor your father and mother, so that your life will be good and long on the fertile land God has given you. Now, since we have 6th to 12th graders in here, I'm just going to say this up front. If you're a kid, if you're, 12 or 47, if you're living in your parents' house, right? Let's just say it this way. Then in some ways, you play by their rules, right? That's the respectful thing to do. So part of honoring your parents, if you're a kid, is to be obedient to your parents. Just do what your parents tell you to do. Now, if your parents are telling you to do things that are unsafe, if your parents are telling you to do things that are legal and dangerous, if your parents are asking you to break the law, if they're putting you in harm's way, then you need to tell somebody. You need to tell me. You need to tell Jess when she's around. You need to tell a school teacher. You need to tell a guidance counselor. You need to tell somebody. If somebody's asking you to do something wrong, illegal, unsafe, don't do it and tell somebody. If your parents tell you to be home at 9:30, and you're mad because you want to come home at 11, that is not unsafe. That is not illegal. That's just, you need to do what they say, right? And I'm telling you, the 16-year-old me would totally throw rotten tomatoes at me right now because that was not my attitude at 16. But as a parent, I've come to understand that as weird as we are and as strange as we can be, we really are looking out for your best interest most of the time. So that's my kind of just blanket statement to those of you who are living at home. And now we'll jump into what about the rest of us? Let's ask this question. To whom is this command addressed, to honor your father and mother? It's addressed to Israelite males who are adults. That's who the Ten Commandments are originally to. And if you want proof of that, go to the last command. The last command is the command, do not covet, and it starts listing property. Do not covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's wife. Now, let me just say this. This is a foreign concept, and we're thankful it's a foreign concept. I'm grateful that women have been given more and more personhood and dignity, and we've got a long way to go in that category. But in the ancient world, women were considered property somewhere just beneath your house, right? You got your house, you got your lady, and you got your, ox or whatever. And so in the ancient world, women were considered property. These commands are written to Israelite adult males. This is how, because those were basically who were considered persons. And again, we don't hold to that view, but that was the lens through which they saw life. So, Israelite adult males are being told, honor your father and mother. And if we want to take this seriously, we have to ask the question, what does it mean to honor? What does it mean to honor someone? The word honor here in Hebrew is the word kavod. It means to be heavy or weighty. It's used of God in other places, and it's used to describe God's glory, like the significance of who God is. And so we might say here that to honor means to regard parents as people of weight and significance, which really, I think, if we could just be honest, is how we should probably treat every human being, right? There should be a sort of understanding that human beings are made in the image of God, and that every one of us, from the best and brightest to the weirdest and most annoying of us, every single one of us have a dignity and a value and a worth that is heavy. It's significant and it's valuable, right? Every human being has worth. And we're told in this command to treat parents as someone of significance. Now, what might that mean to treat them as someone of significance? Let me show you this picture. This is a picture of an insula, I-N-S-U-L-A. This is basically how houses were constructed in Palestine and Judea and Israel in the ancient world. And let's think about how we kind of live our lives. When you turn 18, what happens? Your parents, you graduate, most of the time you graduate high school, and then your parents start designing what they're going to turn your room into, right? Because as soon as you graduate, you go off to college, you're starting your own life, and your parents are putting in a gym. Like that's what's happening. And why to do this? Because you're gonna go and you're gonna get a job, you may get married, you may have some kids, and you're going to move wherever the work is. And so it's possible that we have a family, you know, you live here, but your kids have moved away and they live on the other side of the country or maybe on the other side of the world, right? We have very scattered families, by and large, in the world we live in. In the ancient world, it wasn't sort of you turn 18, you get the boot because mom and dad want to put in a gym. It was essentially when you became of age, you would add on to the family compound because an insula was basically a courtyard with all these houses constructed around it that adjoined one another. And so instead of turning 18 and moving away, you would, whenever you took a wife and you began a family, your parents would help you and you would add on to the family compound. And so that you would have generations and generations of extended family living together. So it's not just you and your parents and your grandparents and great grandparents. It's, you know, your weird cousin and it's your odd uncle and aunt. And it's, you know, you all live together in the same general area. You grow up together. And in most cases you do business together. So you, maybe your family business is growing olive trees to make olive oil, or maybe you have a vineyard to make grow grapes and make wine, or maybe you have some grain fields and you harvest that and you make bread. Whatever your family business is, everybody's doing it, right? Everybody's a part of it. And so in the ancient world, this whole idea of honoring your parents has to do with it's not like you're just coming in to visit for Thanksgiving or Christmas. It's you're right there together, and we're being told to treat our parents as if they were people of significance or weight. And then there's this whole promise that comes along with it. Right, and Deuteronomy restates it a little differently. Honor your father and your mother exactly as the Lord God requires, so that life will be long and so that things will go well for you in the fertile land the Lord your God is giving you. One writer in the New Testament says this is the first command with a promise. You honor your parents and you will get a long life on the fertile land God is giving you. Isn't that a weird promise? But think about it. What happens if you honor your parents? If you honor your parents, your kids see you honor your parents, right? And Patrick Miller says this, the son or daughter who honors becomes the father or mother who is honored. As they have nurtured respect and as they have provided for the good of their parents, they in turn will need the same and have this promise of the same. Their treatment of mother and father becomes a model by which their own children will learn to keep the commandment and what its keeping entails, right? It's when your kids see you honoring your parents, then they're going to honor you. And when their kids see them honoring you, their kids are going to honor them. And it creates a cycle, this kind of like system of honor, where you take care of your parents as they're growing older and they need care. And I mean, because after all, your kids, my kids, they're going to decide what happens to us at some point, right? And so we want to, I mean, in some ways, you better be nice to these kids, right? Because they get to decide what happens to us. And so there's this whole idea of system of honor. And this makes total sense if you grew up, like I was fortunate to grow up, with really good parents. Parents who loved you, parents who cared about you, parents who provided for you. I mean, my parents probably spent too much time telling me how great I was as a kid. You know, if you grew up in that environment, then this whole idea of honoring your parents seems like a logical thing to do. You take care of your parents, you honor your parents because they have in so many ways honored you in life. But I know a ton of people who have not had that experience with their parents. I know a ton of people who their relationship with their parents is one of brokenness. It's one of pain. It's one of abuse. It's one of neglect. It's one of wounds. I know a ton of people who every year when we're out celebrating Father's Day and Mother's Day, it is one of the darkest days of their calendar year. Because those sorts of things just bring up a reminder of what has been taken away or what was not given. So what do you do when you have a parent who has not been good to you, who maybe you would say it like this, if we're just being honest, I don't have a parent that deserves to be honored. I've read some of this book before, but I want to read it again. It's a book called Stumbling Toward Faith by Renee Altson. And the first couple paragraphs of her book, every time I read them, are just so gripping and thought-provoking and challenging. Let's listen to this. I grew up in an abusive household. Much of my abuse was spiritual. Now, when I say spiritual, I don't mean new age, esoteric, random mumblings from half-Wiccan hippie parents. I don't mean that I grew up thinking all the wrong ideas about religion or what it meant to be saved because I was given too much freedom or too many options. I don't mean that my father protested the phrase under God in the Pledge of Allegiance or told me there was more than one way to heaven. I mean that my father raped me while reciting the Lord's Prayer. I mean that my father molested me while singing Christian hymns. I mean that there was one way that I was literally under God and that I could never escape my sinfulness. Never. My father corrupted nearly every single thing that in my deepest moments of belief I see that God created for good or righteousness. He did it slyly without my realizing it. He did it deliberately without regret. He fully convinced me that God was on his side, that I was bad, that I was lucky to be loved by God, by him, by anyone, and that I was to blame for things no child, nobody should ever be blamed for. Now you see, when you come into a person's life like mine and you say honor your parents, that makes total sense. But for somebody like this, when they hear the phrase honor your parents, for them it sounds like you're saying honor your abusers. Honor those who have taken something from you that no one should have taken from them. I grew up in elementary school with a kid who had a lot of trouble when he was younger, but one of the central problems was his father was abusive. And his father was abusive in that he practiced spanking, but he would do the spanking with the belt buckle. And I can remember being at his house when we were kids in the summertime and running around with our shirts off. And I can remember looking at him, and he would have welts and bruises and marks all over him where his father had disciplined and corrected him. And I've kind of, in some ways, been able to follow the trajectory of his life. And it for a while, was very dark and very painful and very difficult. And can you imagine me saying to him, but in the Bible, it says you have to honor your father. This man who is abusive and evil to you. What do we do with these sort of situations? What do we do when the people we're being asked to honor really don't seem to deserve it? How do we begin to approach this command? And I want to take a sideways, so I want to kind of hit pause here, and I want to do a little side detour to Jesus because I find this so fascinating how Jesus kind of reacts to some of the situation about honoring your parents. So Jesus really speaks about this that I could find a few times Jesus speaks to this issue. One time, he's talking about the way we should honor every human being. And this is through a story called The Good Samaritan, is what we call it. And there was a man who was beaten up, and it was the unlikely Samaritan who comes alongside. And essentially, Jesus basically says, every human being deserves our honor in the form of compassion. Every human being deserves that. It doesn't matter what their label is or what their political party is or what their religion is. It doesn't matter. None of that matters. What matters is every human being deserves our honor in the form of compassion. Then another time Jesus talks to the religious leaders because his disciples aren't washing their hands before they eat, which I'm a fan of washing hands before we eat. Actually, I would prefer you sanitize your hands before we even touch, handshake. But hey, whatever. But for us, it's hygiene, right? It's protecting ourselves from these little microbes and things that live on our hands. For them, it was religious. How do you make sure that you're okay to be in God's presence? Well, you have to do these rituals. And they were non-biblical rituals. And so Jesus basically says, you guys have all these rules. But the reality is there's this one command in the Bible, honor your father and mother. And you say that whatever you would do to honor your parents, instead you give to God and you're not taking care of your parents. And so you are nullifying the commands of God to keep your traditions, right? So Jesus is essentially advocating that we honor our parents and take care of our parents in that way. But this next story is the one I find so interesting. Jesus entered a house, Mark 3, a crowd gathered again. There's a buzz about Jesus. It's very early in his ministry, but people are talking about he's doing these things. He's saying these things. He's challenging convention. He's challenging the religious and political status quo. He and his disciples couldn't even eat. When his family heard what was happening, they came to take control of him. They were saying he's out of his mind. Who is this? Jesus' family. Jesus' family think he's gone crazy. How many of you in this room have ever had family members accuse you of being crazy? You and Jesus have a lot in common. isn't there some sort of strange comfort in the fact that Jesus had family who thought he was crazy? Like, even Jesus had dysfunction. Even Jesus' family could have probably, you know, done a stop on Springer, right? Isn't that some sort of like, oh, we're not, it's not just us. Does anybody else feel that way? It's not just us. Notice what happens a little later in the story. His mother and brothers arrived at the house. They stood outside and sent word to him, calling for him. A crowd was seated around him, and those sent to him said, look, your mother, brothers, and sisters are outside looking for you. And they've got a couple guys in white coats who want to talk to you. That's funny. It's funny. Ha ha. You know, the straight jack wasting my good stuff today, and you guys aren't even giving me anything. What do you think Jesus does? How does Jesus respond to this? He's crazy. They think he's crazy. They show up, and they're intending to take him home. Right? Because Jesus is, you know, it was cute at first. You were going around talking about God, and you were doing stuff, and people liked you. But now it's become a problem. Now you're getting attention from the political side of the coin. You're getting attention from the religious authorities. People are starting to ask questions about you. And to just to be totally honest, the family is embarrassed. I mean, you're going around stirring up trouble, and everybody's asking us at the grocery store if we know what Jesus has been up to lately. And so we would rather just come home with us. Let's go back to the carpentry. Let's go back to the skills. Let's go back and do, you know, just go home and earn a living, and let's lay low and let's keep our nose down, and everybody will forget this happened. And that's not what Jesus decides to do. Jesus replied, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? Looking at those seated around him in a circle, he said, look, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother, sister, and mother. Now remember, in the ancient world, kinship was deeply ingrained in birth. It was, this is your family. You live with these people. You live for generations with these same people. You don't deviate outside of this. Jesus, we got a little room and a little house waiting on you and the missus to show up and move into, right? That's how it works. And in this moment, Jesus radically redefines what it means to be family. Jesus radically, he says, actually, family isn't just a blood issue. Family is a relational issue. Notice what William Barclay says. True kinship lies in a common experience, especially when it is an experience where two people have really come through things together. I know people who, when they go to Thanksgiving dinner at their family and somebody brings up religion, things get really awkward. Anybody else ever had that experience before? You're growing, you're learning, you're being transformed by your experience of God. You're learning all sorts of new things that you're interested about, and you want to share them because it's actually changing your life, and you're finding that the Jesus you've experienced now is better than the Jesus you thought you knew, and all this stuff's happening to you, and you sit down at the table and somebody says something about religion and you start talking about your newfound hope that you've experienced in this new way of seeing Jesus, and everybody gets really quiet and a yam falls on a plate. And it's really, really awkward. How many of you have ever experienced family drama or strain because of how you were growing and what you were learning spiritually? Anybody ever experienced that? Anybody ever had a situation where now you know when you go home for Christmas, you don't bring up the central themes of Christmas? Right? It's Christmas. We can't talk about Jesus. We've got to find something else. Man, that turkey was good this year, right? Is there football on? Please, God, let there be football on, right? That's sort of our Thanksgiving prayer. I know lots of people for whom their faith has actually made it impossible for them to be close to people they once were close to because something that was shared is no longer shared. Right? I also know people who, when their world has begun to fall apart, when someone they love has suddenly passed, when somebody has wounded them, when some of their flesh and blood haven't been there for them, they have found a group of people, perhaps in a small group or in a church like ours, they have found people who, on those worst days, when even their flesh and blood abandoned them, there is a group of people who came alongside them and said, we're not going anywhere. And for them, when they think of church, when they think of family, first and foremost, the people that pop into their brain are the people that they take bread and dip it in a cup with every single week. It's people that they sit down with and they can be honest about anything with. It's the people they can bear their heart and soul to. It's the people they can be honest about where they are. Not only what they believe, but what they don't believe. And not only about what they feel like they know, but all the things they may doubt. They can just kind of bear their soul to this group of people. And it's liberating and it's life-changing. And Jesus actually says, look, my mother and brothers are going to have to be the people who are on the kingdom movement with me. It's going to have to be people who are moving forward to this new way of living and understanding. And the good news is Jesus' mother and brothers, most of them seem to have come around. His mother seems to have come around. His brother, James, ended up being one of the leaders of the church of Jerusalem. So there's always like this hope for them coming around. But Jesus essentially says, my mission can't be stopped because people don't understand it. Like, sometimes don't you think we need to write that down and just put it on every surface we can find? My mission can't be stopped because some people don't understand it. Jesus had family drama. Jesus had difficulty. Jesus understood what it was like to go home for a Shabbat dinner and everything to be super, super weird. So what do we do with that? What do we do with those who have wronged us? Jesus seems to have drawn some boundaries. And here's what I'll say. I think for lots and lots of people, that's where we have to live. We have to live with boundaries. So if we're thinking about that, how do we begin to honor our parents? Especially, I'm talking about our parents. I mean, if you've had great parents, you know how to do that, right? You care for them. You love them. You show them respect. You give them the dignity they deserve. You treat them and care for them with every ounce of love they've given you over the years. That's a no-brainer. What do you do for those of us who, though, your parents were maybe abusive, maybe not even physically, but they were mentally and emotionally abusive? They told you, you know, I have friends who their parents told them regularly how awful they were and how nothing good could come of them. How do you possibly seek to honor somebody like that? And so I would offer just a few thoughts. I think one of the ways we can honor our parents, even if they've been lousy, is with gratitude. How many of you in this room right now exist? Okay, for those of you who don't, we honor your choice at non-existence. I'm assuming that you really do, though, whether you're acknowledging it or not. You exist, and you didn't have to, right? You didn't have to exist. And if you had not existed, then your relationships, maybe your spouse, your children, your friends, your grandkids, all the people who have come to depend on you and love you, and you have been such a central part of their lives, you wouldn't have been there had you not existed. Perhaps the only thing you can say to your parents, because there needs to be a boundary there because they're toxic and abusive and everything they touch ends up being infected with this toxicity, perhaps the only thing you can say is, look, thank you for giving me life. Really. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be alive. I would not have all this joy I experience as a regular part of my life. I would not have these people I love. None of the good things that I have and none of the good things I'm a part of would have ever existed had you not chosen to give me life. And so however that came about, however that choice was made, I just want to say I'm alive and I appreciate my existence. And for some people, they are so toxic, I really believe for some of us, that's the line. We live with a gratitude for them giving us life, and that's all we can do, because what I found is that toxic people want to spread that. It's just kind of by nature. It's almost like the flu. They don't even know it at times. They just sneeze on you, and then you have it, right? I mean, that's sort of how it ends up working. So for some of us, there has to be this boundary there, because if we let them in our lives, then not only are they going to affect us, they're going to affect our kids, and they're going to affect the people, our spouse. They're just a million. There's sort of a ripple effect in relationships, and when we allow toxic people to take up residence in our lives, the ripple effect gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, I'll say this too. I don't think that it's impossible for people to change. I really believe people can change. I've seen change. I've experienced change in my life. But the person who can lead that person, your father and mother, whoever, and by the way, if you have a great parent situation, then just think of this as whoever it is you need to deal with, all right? So whoever that person is you need to deal with, you can't be the person to change them. You can't be the person to help lead them to change. You can't. It just will not work that way. You'll end up getting pulled into a cycle of dysfunction that's unhealthy. So perhaps it's a boundary. We can't be friends. We don't do Thanksgiving, Christmas. Please lose my phone number. And I want you to know I'm so grateful to be alive and that you played a role in that. And for that, I'm grateful. The second thing I would say is, turn this on. Honor might take the role of forgiveness. Now, I think there's a view of forgiveness that gets passed around within Christian circles that's very unhealthy, and that is this. You just need to forgive and forget. It's that easy. Bippity-boppity-boo, gone. You're done. You've forgiven them, and everything's back to normal, and y'all are going to lunch together again, and everything's great, and Christmas is not going to be weird, and Thanksgiving's going to be awesome, and all the it's all going to be perfect. That's not life. That's not the real world. That's not how it works. Forgiveness is a journey. Period. It takes time. Some days you take massive leaps forward. Anybody had this experience? People in your life you try to forgive. Some days you wake up and you really believe that if they were right in this room, that you could walk up to them and say to them, I forgive you. And if they were on fire, you would totally put them out. But then there are other days when perhaps you're the one who started the fire. You know what I'm saying? Like we go back and forth, and that's a natural sort of part of the human journey, and it's a part of, as we try to allow God to heal us from this brokenness and these wounds, there are natural sorts of ebb and flow. Some days I feel like the people in my life who've hurt me, I could just forgive them, and I could even walk up and give them a hug, and I could say, you know what? I don't hold this against you. And there are some days I want to desperately hold it against them, and that's part of the journey. That's part of the journey. And when you start feeling guilty about the days you can't be so free to forgive, then it makes it harder for you to move forward. So I think some days you just have to acknowledge, I'm having a bad day. I'm having a bad day. It's not an easy day for me to forgive. I hope nobody cuts me off in traffic because it's going to get ugly quick. You know what I mean? Like, there are those moments when you just have to just say, okay, this is what it is, and I can't make it something it's not. Forgiveness is it's a journey. It's a moment-by-moment decision not to seek to hold against them what they've done. And here's the real truth, that when we forgive people, when we refuse to forgive people, the person that's really being wounded isn't the person we're not forgiving. The person being wounded is us. Because often they are off living their lives, doing whatever they want, and they are not the least bit concerned about how they've affected us. And yet we're sitting around with all sorts of bitterness. And bitterness is sort of like this. I asked 9 o'clock, and they didn't know about this. Maybe you do. You ever heard of kudzu before? You guys know what kudzu is? Okay, kudzu. Is it around here? Some places, maybe. Some people saying no. Some people, kudzu, in eastern Kentucky, it's this plant that takes over everything. And the minute it gets a root, like, there'll be entire, and this is going to show my holler raisin, but it takes root and it covers an entire creek bank. And if you're not careful, it'll cover your buildings and your houses. And if you leave your car sitting too long, it's going to get that too, right? It's just like, just creeps and crawls and it spreads over time. And it's almost like one, you don't even notice it happening. And I really think unforgiveness and bitterness end up doing the same thing. They end up entangling us. And it happens so subtly, and it happens over time. And suddenly a person who may have been a bit optimistic and a bit hopeful and a bit kind and compassionate has now become a calloused, hardened, negative sort of person. I was watching the West Virginia football game last night, and I was texting my dad, and we'd come back and we'd tied the game and we were about to force overtime, and I just texted my dad and I said, we're awful, we're going to lose, watch. And I realized, even about something dumb, I've become bitter in a very dumb sort of way. And it happens in the dumbest of ways, but then it happens in the most significant ways, because somebody really has hurt you and it needs to be addressed. And by not addressing it at all, you just allow this bitterness to infect you and take over, and you spread it to the people you love the most. And I have family members who, when I'm around them, it takes an extra dose of like vitamin C and positivity to survive, because they have such a negative sort of, you know, just attitude about life and everything and everybody. And I don't want to be that way. And I think the only way not to be that way is to enter into a journey of forgiveness. And then this last, I would say, honor can be seeking to break the cycle. If you had parents who were mean to you and unkind to you and neglected you and abusive to you, they were mentally and emotionally and physically hard on you, perhaps the greatest way you can honor what they should have been is when you refuse to perpetuate that cycle with your children. And some of the people I knew growing up who had the worst family situations, I see them now on Facebook, and for what Facebook can tell you, it really seems like they are loving parents to their kids. And it's sort of it's so good to see. And I've actually had conversations with people where they're like, my parents were so lousy. When I become a parent, I'm never going to make my kid feel alone or uncared for or like nobody's there for them. And I see these parents who now are taking such careful attention to make sure that happens. But in order to do that, I really think we have to acknowledge the stuff we're carrying around with us. Brennan Manning says that whatever is denied can't be healed. Whatever is denied can't be healed. Whatever it is that we're refusing to acknowledge, and I think we have this sort of culture where we're trying to create this, well, I'm better than that, and I'm going to rise above it, and I'm not, you know, I don't even need to deal with it. And the reality is, every wound you have that you refuse to look at and acknowledge will be seeking a way to be expressed. And that usually comes out in the most negative, dysfunctional, painful sorts of ways. I mean, generally, where does addiction begin? It begins with a wound. Where does our self-loathing begin? It begins with what somebody has said or done to us that we've never acknowledged or we've never sought to deal with, and it over time grows and grows and grows. Perhaps to break the cycle of dysfunction and pain in family relationships, perhaps it's when we choose to say, I'm not going to do that with my kids or my grandkids. I'm going to do this. I'm going to acknowledge the mistakes of the past. I'm going to acknowledge the pain of the past, and I'm going to seek to move forward in healthy, whole, life-giving sorts of ways. Family trauma and family history can be rewritten, or at least can be given a new, fresh start. Isn't that why we love stories? Isn't that why we love movies that end happily? Because something is overcome and something new and in some ways better is put in its place. And you cannot get the past back, but there's this great line in the Bible that talks about how God redeems the past. And that our past, as painful as it was, it doesn't have to be for naught. And if we're willing to be open and allow the Spirit of God to work in us and transform us, if we're willing to acknowledge what needs to be healed, even if we're not sure what that is, if we're just willing to open ourselves up. Some of this means sitting down with a therapist or a counselor, somebody who can give us direction. We have a couple really good therapists, counselors, who are part of our community here who would love to be able to sit down with some of us and just be a place where we could just vomit everything out and get some wise counsel. So if you need to talk to somebody, if you need a community of people to come around you, I really believe you're in the right spot. If you feel alone and isolated, please let us plug you into a small group. Because that, in my experience, when I felt alienated from everybody and everything, it's been that group of people who's kept me grounded and kept me sane. And so if you aren't in a community that's healthy and you aren't growing and you're not in a place where you're being free to discuss and acknowledge the pain of your life, please come see me. See one of our elders. We want to help with that. We want to connect you with somebody to talk to. We want to connect you with somebody who can help on this journey, just the next step, the next right thing, the next step toward wholeness and healing. Does that make sense? I'm going to pray, and we're going to get ready to, we'll dismiss this part, and we'll get ready for lunch for those of you who are staying. I'm going to hang around down front for a bit, though. If you would like to talk or pray, we have elders in the room as well who can assist you and pray with you and talk to you. And if we need to connect you with somebody else, we'd be really happy to. Because I realize this kind of topic can dredge up all sorts of wounds. And so we don't want to leave when those things are at the surface. We want to begin to deal with them. So please come grab me if you need to talk or pray. And we'll begin that journey together. God, we're grateful for this day. We're grateful for this hope that our lives aren't lived alone, that not only do we live and move and have our being in you, but that we've been given one another. We've been given one another for the journey. We've been given one another for the joys and pains, the celebration and the heartbreak of life. As a community, may we come around one another. May those who need to cry be given shoulders to cry on. May we weep with those who weep. And we long for what we believe you can do in these situations, which is provide healing and hope and wholeness. We ask all these things in the strong name of Jesus, and everybody said, amen.